It, you know, I mean, it gives you so much respect for the, for your leader to get out there and actually lead. You know, and I just after I read your book about that part and what he was doing, it, it gave me a greater respect for that man. But also, Kevin Holla was episode 70. So for our listeners, if you haven't listened to Kevin's story yet, go take a listen to it. It's excellent.
Yeah. Well, it was easy to find Kevin in the backwoods of North Carolina because he was the guy walking around carrying a huge log. So we figured that out. That's how he was training. But for you, Adam, if I were to see a platoon of guys standing out there, you know, would I know, you know, just as an Army guy, would I know that some of you were like, as they say on Sesame Street, one of these things is not like the other? Was there anything about the way you equipped, you dressed, that set you apart when you were in uniform from other folks, or was it just totally indistinguishable?
Totally indistinguishable, and I'll tell you why. If we are out with Delta, we are dressed exactly like them. If we are out with the SEALs, I mean, we, again, the JSOC community, they dressed the same. We had the same weapons. We had the same capability of buying equipment. We had a decent amount of fund to buy what we need. But if you see me in an airport in, let's say, Heathrow, you will not, you will think I'm just a very gray guy who's traveling, like either a businessman or the good thing, like I told you, we were chameleons. If we needed to travel as a businessman, then we looked like businessmen. We all, obviously, we were all fit because you're still in the Army. You still have to do the Army fitness test. You still have to do your military schools. You still have to, there is still an Army standard that you have to follow. But you're not going to see me with a high and tight haircut. You might see me with facial hair. You might not see me with facial. It depends on the situation. But you will not be able to tell who we are. No, I don't think you'll. And so far, that's why so far I'm the first guy who was an operative to write a book. So far, people don't know us, and we like to keep it that way.
Well, you just begged the question, so you kind of led into it. So why, you know, not so much why, because I know you say you discuss that in the book, but we just had a lady named Jonna Mendez on. She was the chief of disguise for CIA. Her husband, Tony, was the one that the Argo movie made famous. I just went out to a book signing with her, was talking with her, and I've talked with a lot of the agency folks over the years, and they made an interesting statement about why they made Argo so public. They said, you know, usually the only time you hear about stuff is you hear about failures. You don't hear about successes. And George Tenet, when he was the director of Central Intelligence, wanted to tell a story. So they pushed the declassification. You know, the tradecraft and stuff had changed so much, it wasn't going to affect anything. What motivated, because you could have wrote all the books you want, and all it took was somebody at DOD to go, sorry, you know, stamp it. Nope, you know, not approved. You know, they could have just nuked you completely. What was it that allowed your book to get through?
But I wish I knew. I think, first of all, let me take this opportunity actually to thank current and former unit and JSOC leadership for allowing me to follow the process, for the process to go through. I sat with DOD personnel, security personnel, and those were not normal DOD. Those were JSOC, DEVGRU, Green Delta, SOCOM, and obviously people from the unit as well were sitting there. So I think just because I was able to balance between telling a story, again, it's a story of an immigrant, hopefully it does inspire some people and help some people find a way and have some hope in America. And I balance between that and protecting national security and protecting mission, protecting personnel who are currently doing missions, and protecting personnel who done missions in the past. So maybe DOD got to the point where, like, you know what, this guy is using his First Amendment right, and he did not go out of that. Maybe DOD decided it's a good story to be told. They didn't tell me that, and they didn't tell me why, the reason. All I know is they redacted a good amount of things in the beginning. I had a lawyer who was taking me through the steps. And I told the lawyer obviously wanted to go to court because it's good publicity and it's good for the book, it's good for the lawyer. So if it's money, it's good to go to court. I didn't want to go to court. It was not, I didn't write the book for the money. But what I told the lawyer, I said, ask them if I can sit with them. and we go over all the stuff they redacted, and we can take it step by step. And if something that we agree on the redaction, 100% will redact it. I'm not here to dime anybody out or to put people at risk. If we can agree on putting it back, we'll put it back or we'll change it. So I sat with them for 4 hours. We went over everything. The first 20 minutes were spent over the title of the book. So the original title of the book was redacted.
And if we unredacted it, what would it have been?
So that's a very
good question. We'd have to kill you if we told you.
Hold on, let me tell you. I forgot. They redacted it off my brain. That's not good. No, so even the pictures in the book, they were approved by DOD. So we went over everything step by step. From my side, I felt it's a story that I think it should be told. Not about me. And as you guys read the book, you'll see that I'm talking about the great men and women who are, let me underline women. A lot of people don't think women are in the special operation community. They serve extremely well. They carrying their weight as much as the guys. So I'm doing this for the great men and women who are actually currently serving, previously served. It's hopefully something that gives them something to brag about, gives them some comfort in their stories being told.
Now, folks, there's going to be a little bit of an awkward pause here because we were recording with Adam. We were going along really good, and then Murph went and did it. He said a code word that was classified. Last thing I saw were three guys in balaclavas saying, "This is for Adam," snatched him, and then the power went out.
And they broke the damn window here in the condo, just so you know. Somebody's got to fix that shit.
Now, Adam, can you confirm or deny you were behind this?
Is that where you got the blue eye from? Did they give you a blue eye?
I see a blue eye?
Yeah. I see something there in your eyes. Yeah.
It's called lying. It's called guilt.
Yeah. So we've determined Adam will neither confirm nor deny he was behind the snatch operation of Murphy. Apparently, after having him for a few minutes, they realized, shit, we're going to give him back.
They're right.
That was called an unrendition. So they renditioned him, then they unrenditioned him. They said, sorry, pal, you're too big of a problem.
That's right. That's right.
Hey, so let's kick back into where
food.
We...
They found out he was going to eat their food.
Never eat their food. So where we ended up at was, Adam, we were talking about your book, about what you were doing at the process of redactions. You were going through it, and you wanted to make sure the story was being told. And then, Murph, right when you got snatched and the power went out completely, you had a follow-up you wanted to do about. You said one of the facts out of his book.
It did. And a lot of the people that we bring on here are humble, and they don't tell you. I mean, I know in Adam's case here, a lot of it's classified, so he can't tell you. But he's also being humble about their accomplishments. And so since it's in the book and it's not redacted, I presume that this is not classified. But I just want to point out to our listeners that he says in between, and you wonder what these guys are doing and why their operations are classified. Well, here's the results. And I think I've got this right, Adam. Between 2003 and 2009, you were in and out of Africa. And you estimate that you got stopped between 30 and 40 terrorist attacks in the United States alone and at least 50 terrorist attacks worldwide. That's good info, right?
That is good info. And we kept it very vague to make sure that it's not.
And understandably so.
Yeah.
Understandably so, but that is why we have groups like the Unit, why we have DEVGRU, why we have Delta.
Special Mission Unit Delta.
I mean, absolutely. All the JSOC groups that are out there, Joint Special Operations
Special Forces, yeah.
You guys, Rangers, MARSOC, everybody, you guys are phenomenal. I got to toot your freaking horn here for you because we don't appreciate what we have in the United States. You do because you experienced the other side and then you chose to come here and you saw how good it could be. But the people that live in the United States that have never been out of this country, we don't appreciate what we have here. You know, I would love for it to be mandatory. Morgan's lived out of the country. I've lived out of the country. You've lived out of the country more than both of us combined, I'm sure. And when you, as much as I love Colombia, and I do, I mean, that's my second favorite country in the world after the United States. But what it did for me, I was offered I was being considered to be the head of DEA in Colombia and a couple other countries in South America. And when I was talking to our administrator at the time, I declined. And she said, why? And I said, the one thing that being in Colombia did for me, you know, during the search for Escobar, it made me appreciate living in the United States. I love traveling the world. I love visiting other countries. I love my friends from all the other countries. But I always want to come home, man. There's no place like here. And you guys went out of your way to make it safe for us to have what we have here. So I'll shut up now because I know Morgan's wanting to talk and he's doing his best not to interrupt me. But I'm just so freaking proud of what you and the people that you worked with did. And if we don't get that out, I got it out now, brother. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
No, all said from the heart.
Can I just make a quick cut? I know Morgan's going to beat me up, but
No. Go ahead. Real quick.
I used to be coming back from missions more than once. I would get pulled in the secondary. And people thought it was very annoying. Like, I'm a guy who's coming from a mission. I'm a U.S. Army Special Mission Unit guy, special operation guy. But every time after the immigration guy or the TSA guy harasses you, doing his job, basically, for a bit. And when he goes and he's like, welcome home, that's what exactly Steve is talking about. When he says that, welcome home, it gives you goosebumps, honestly.
And
you're
like, it just did.
Yeah, I am home.
I got to tell one more story here. When Connie and I were transferring, we were a permanent change of station from Columbia back to the United States. We got stationed in Greensboro, North Carolina. We had just adopted our second daughter. She had not left the country yet, left Columbia yet. So she's still a Colombian citizen, although our adoption process was legal. We had all these papers, and the embassy got all the papers, and they put it in packets for each daughter because they're immigrating to the United States. And they actually melted wax on the outside of it and put the ambassador's ring stamp in this hot wax. Yep. And it was big warning signs to be opened by U.S. immigration only and all this stuff. Well, we had trouble with in Colombia at the time, DAS was the equivalent of immigration in the United States. And so as we're trying to leave the country, they're like, well, we need a birth certificate for your daughter there. And I'm like, for the one that had been out of the country, the older one, she'd already been to the United States twice. I'm like, you have it on file. Look in your computer. We don't computerize those records. You either give us a copy of her birth certificate or she's not leaving Colombia. Well, we got a stewardess coming off the plane saying, the captain says you got 3 minutes and they're closing the door. I mean, we're panicking. So I broke the seal, took a copy of the birth certificate, gave it to the DAS officials, and we ran to the plane, got on. Now we're flying into Miami. And I'm thinking, oh, crap, man, because now the seal's been broken. It's going to be a bunch of grief. It's just going to be a hassle. We're going to miss our connecting flight to North Carolina, all this stuff. And here comes Mongo, the immigration officer. Boom, boom. You know, he's like 6'8", comes in, just menacing looking. And he says, go wait in that room there. And I'm like, yes, sir. So the four of us, we go in and sit down. The girls are, they're being pretty good, actually. And Mongo comes in, and he looks at the pack, and he said, the seal has been broken. Did you not read the warning label? And I'm like, sir, let me explain what happened. I told him who I was and what happened. He listened to the story. He looked at us, looked at the girls. He said, one thing I want to say to you right now, welcome home. Yeah. I'm like, oh, man. You talk about all the stress just dissipated, There's no feeling like it. There's no feeling like that.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Okay, Morgan, your turn.
Hey, no, this is all good stuff. Hey, so let's go backwards just a little bit to go forward. So when you talk in your book about some of the operations that were interrupted, in the terrorism planning cycle, there's always a point to where they're about to go operational. There's initial intelligence collection, recon on the target, training, rehearsals, things like that. When you were called in to disrupt, what kind of phase were they in? Were they more closer to the planning to go operational, or were you trying to get farther left of boom, to take them out before they could even get close to operational? The reason I say that is there's always a fine line about when do you pull the trigger, metaphorically speaking. If you pull it too soon, you might give away sources and methods or some stuff that you want. If you do it too late, you might miss the chance to get them before they go operational. So what was your guys' mindset about at what point did you start interdicting, and interrupting these terrorist events?
So to give credit to everybody else as well, in our task force, the FBI was heavily involved. So a lot of those things were done in coordination between us, FBI, other agencies, other government agencies, in addition to other JSOC units. So sometimes in Africa, which that's what I was trying to highlight in the book a bit, is like it was more of the mouth of the river where a lot of things were coming from there. However, and unfortunately, we used to have these young immigrants who are immigrated to the U.S. with their family. They got radicalized somewhere in the process, and they would be going to Africa for training. Luckily, we were interdicting a lot of these guys when they landed in Africa. So they were tracked. Obviously, it wasn't us tracking them in the U.S. That was the FBI. But we were part of the equation with the training camps in Africa. We were monitoring extremist training camps. We would see guys coming into the training camps. We see guys for how long they stay in the training camp, what they do in the training camp. So we had a very good picture. So sometimes we interdicted these guys. If they were like, you know, you had an 18, 19-year-old, I'm not going to say what nationality and American, but they were American plus family came from somewhere else, mostly from somewhere in East Africa. And they would fly a lot of the training camps were in Somalia. So they wouldn't fly to Somalia directly, obviously. They would fly somewhere else as tourists. And then from there, they would get their way into Somalia, do the training, then come back. With a lot of these guys, they were young enough that when they landed in that third country, they would get pulled in. They would get kind of like arrested, detained. And then the FBI, honestly, we would get all the stuff that we needed for us as an organization. And then the FBI would call their families. Believe it or not, the FBI would be like, hey, Mr. So-and-so, we have your son here. And your son was planning on doing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Sometimes the process, obviously, the guy would be arrested, detained for a bit. He hadn't committed a crime yet. So the best case scenario, you get in the guy before he got involved in extremist groups, got the training, got all of these things. Sometimes we were not lucky to get them in the beginning, so we would get them at the end. And this is where they would be on their way to the U.S. or on their way to other Arab countries. And then from those Arab countries, they would make their way either to Iraq, to Afghanistan, to where there is a U.S. embassy somewhere. And believe it or not, sometimes these guys were like, you know, they go to the training camp, they get their training and everything, and they'll take a dhow from East Africa to the Arabian Gulf, and we would be waiting for them there. A lot of times, obviously, when we are in those countries, if we're waiting for them on the other side, that was cooperation with host nation. We would work with host nation. We would tell host nation exactly where the guy is at, get them the location, get them why we think he's a bad guy. We have the evidence. Basically, we would prepare the entire target package for that individual. And then host nation, sometimes they wouldn't want like white Americans to be going out with them because they don't want to show like there are American forces there. In more than one occasion, because I did fit the profile, I would be with host nation. Like in the discussion, they didn't know I was what unit I was from. They just thought I was either a government civilian. So they would think I'm an intel guy from a government organization. Or they would just think I'm a regular special operation guy. But most of the time, they thought I was introduced by the embassy personnel as a government civilian. But we would take them in their way back from the after they're done with their training camps. So the majority of the time, it was in the beginning. Again, without giving sources and methods. But if we could not get them in the beginning, we wanted to get them before they get radicalized. If they got the training and everything, then it's too late. And then at that time, you're detaining the guy to take him to court.
Yeah, because, you know, they kind of divide things up what they call like AORs, areas of responsibility. And if you think of like Africa, I mean, look, this is all open source information. But anytime I start thinking, whether it's Somalia, that area out there, I think Al-Shabaab, you know, I think the folks that we know that are sending people from the U.S., especially the Minnesota area, going down, getting that training and then coming back. Why do I know this? Because I have friends up in Minnesota. Actually, one of my friends now is the director of public safety for the entire state of Minnesota. And this has been one of the challenges, exactly what you're saying, Adam, is we've got to interdict them before they go out and they get the training. Because once they get the training, once they get the indoctrination, now they have operational capabilities, you know, and you want to interdict that. Out of those, Well, let's just put it this way, without discussing areas, but you know, there are terrorist groups out there whose names are well known. Which ones concern you right now in terms of security for the United States? Which ones, you know, we don't want you to get away details of operations you did, but knowing what you know about some of the groups that are out there, which are the ones that concern you now about what's going on, about operating in the United States?
So honestly, not giving away anything, and this is, again, I left the government about 8 years ago, so some of my information is just based on reading and what's going on out there. This might shock a lot of people, and it's very unfortunate. But my fear is during the evacuation of U.S. personnel out of Afghanistan and evacuating, obviously, our interpreters, our allies, our friends, all the people who helped us, because we didn't understand the full picture of what's going on. My fear is like some of the extremist group from Afghanistan made it to the U.S. And when the opportunity arises, they might strike. We could not know who's who in Afghanistan, like who's Taliban, who's not Taliban. I know for, based on my current job, I know for a fact it was $3,000-$4,000 for an Afghan to buy all the documents, all the right paperwork to prove that he is eligible for SIV, to get the paperwork, to get the documentation to apply for an SIV. And some of them are in the pipeline now, waiting to make it to the U.S. if they did not make it to the U.S. already.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Some of those refugees ended up here in Loudoun County, and they were looking at how to disperse them. But that goes back to is if you can't verify who they are, you know, coming into the country, they take it. You take it, and these folks out there. This is what they do. They take advantage of a crisis like that. You've got Abbey Gate. You had the withdrawal from Afghanistan. You had 13 of our service people killed. And there's chaos and confusion. And in that chaos and confusion here, so people just don't misunderstand this too much. It only took 19 people to start an entire global war, 19 hijackers. So don't think there has to be a ton of people. Well, you know, there's not 1,000 people, 20, 30 people. That's enough. I mean, that would scare me. Having 20 or 30 people, highly trained, highly motivated, highly organized, operating in this area.
Can I give you something exclusive for your guys' show?
Yeah. Of course. No, we don't want anything exclusive. We just want to be a run-of-the-mill podcast. Fire away, figuratively speaking.
I was in Afghanistan during the evacuation. For my current job, nothing for what I was doing with the military. I was in Afghanistan during the evacuation. I was in a place where there was like British SAS guys. I was able to get out, to go through Abbey's Gate, the one you're talking about, to go through to the airport, to get evacuated to Qatar from Afghanistan. So I am I didn't hear the story. I've seen it firsthand. I've seen you brought 20-year-old Marines. God bless them, but you actually gave them the responsibility to evacuate, to organize the evacuation of these people, to say who can get on a flight, who can't. I've seen a female went down on her knees crying because she's like, if I make it outside of this airport, they're going to kill me. The Marine was about to cry. And at the end, I mean, people go back and forth and everybody's chaos, extreme chaos. And people trying to figure out who should get on the flight, who shouldn't get on the flight. When I made it to Qatar, she was there. Again, most likely 99.9%. She did deserve to leave Afghanistan. She needed to leave Afghanistan. But we had a lot of other people who left. I mean, it was like just if you made it to the airport, that's why there was a lot of attacks, not attacks, physical, not a terrorist attack. Well, the terrorist attack, that was a different story. But what I mean by it was like a stampede. Everybody was going towards the airport because what was told to everybody in Afghanistan, in Kabul, if you make it to the airport, the U.S. will take you out. So I was in Afghanistan and I've seen it. And again, that's my fear where, especially with what's happening in the Middle East now, you have people going to be like, okay, well, I cannot tolerate or I cannot take this anymore. Let me just take some action. And all it takes just one crazy guy off one of those bridges on a highway, drop a car or something. Like I don't want to give people an idea, but a terrorist attack is not as hard as a lot of Americans think. I've seen what you're talking about. I've seen people in Loudoun County. I've seen them everywhere. I've seen people, I've heard of people actually made it to, and this is, I was involved in helping, a lot of veterans were involved in helping getting Afghans out. So I was in one, in more than one group where we helping our, the people that we knew that they worked with us. But in the process too, that was like, hey guys, there is a bus of so-and-so, and you don't know who's in the bus, who's not in the bus, but there was a couple of rape cases in El Paso, in Fort Bliss, where they had the refugees there. They were stuck there for a while, and I think one of them raped or tried to rape a Marine E5. So we have to just be careful with, and again, I go back, I didn't want to like beat the dead horse. I go back to the lack of understanding of the culture. So I've seen like, and I've seen people lying from certain cultures. I know they were lying because they understand the culture, but these people, and I put it in the book, they passed the polygraph because they came from a culture of shame, not a culture of guilt. So Americans who did not interact a lot with different cultures and different nationalities, they feel bad. They think, why that guy is lying? He wouldn't lie. Why should he lie? And they believe a lot of the lies that we are given, and then we end up with not the so right people in the U.S. Again, I'm not against like Afghans coming to the U.S. or Arabs coming. I'm an immigrant myself, but I'm with having the right process to bring people in.
You know, going back to your book here, and if our listeners are wondering what would the responsibilities be of these people that were able to infiltrate the United States, we've in page 110, you talk about in Manchester, England, where the police or MI5 or MI6 found a manual on a guy's computer, and his file was titled Military Stuff, Call to Jihad. And you, I love the way you said it should have just been word, Dear Cops, here's what you're looking for.
Yes.
But within that file was the missions required of a military organization, talking about the terrorists. And I'm not going to go through all these. It's listed on page 112 and 113 if you get Adam's book, and I highly recommend you do so you can educate yourself more about what goes on. But there's not, of these eight instructive instructions here, there's not a single one of these that's good for us and as Americans. You know, it outlines right here what it is they're expected to do, and it's all killing and taking advantage of us. And it's an eye opener, I guess, would be a nice way to describe that.
And that manual sat in the FBI office for a couple of years before it was translated because it had a lot of military stuff and the FBI civilian translators. Again, fellow brothers and sisters, nothing against them, but they didn't understand. Either they didn't understand the urgency, or they just didn't understand the military aspect of it. And a lot of those things were taken from U.S. field manuals. They actually, you know, somebody took the field manuals, translated
it's,
them.
It's just like a prosecutor. It's just like a prosecutor, Morgan. And have you ever met a prosecutor that said you have too much evidence to prosecute someone?
Yeah, right.
Never.
They don't exist. Yeah.
So how can you have too much information when you're going after these international terrorist groups that have vowed to kill us? You cannot have too much information.
And our problem is we've never had enough. And well, here's the problem. We've had the information, but it's just like 9/11 and some other stuff. We failed to connect the dots. We had too many systems out there that didn't talk to each other, too many people wanting to go do their own thing without sharing information and collaborating. And at the end of the day, we had too many people, I think, well, I want to be the hero. And it's like, dude, it ain't about you being the hero. It's about making sure somebody doesn't make the news. It's about making sure an operation doesn't go off. I could, you know, Murph, you remember the days too, back on the street, nobody gave a shit about who put out the press release. What we cared about was, look what we did. We got the guy, we got the, you know, we got the dope, you know, we found the fugitive, whatever else. It was all about, the reward was accomplishing the mission. It wasn't about who got to put out the press release.
Right. Right.
Sorry, and that was my rant there, Adam, if you didn't notice.
And I know, and I'm not going to, again, beat the dead horse. I agree with you 100%. I can give you thousands of examples of situations like this, but I will spare your listeners the agony of listening to me complain about other government agencies.
We do it all the time on here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we're not going to do that.
Hey, let's do this. Well, let's keep it positive. Let's talk about, because we, before we kicked back in and after we discovered that Murph was released unrenditioned because he was eating their food. I just got verification of that. He was nibbling on their stuff. One of the awards you've received, which for me is next to the Congressional Medal of Honor and maybe the Silver Star, depending on what branch you're in, but to me, the Purple Heart is to me one of the things that I have the most reverence for because of what people went through. You, when we talk, you, part of the operation is still classified, some of it's unclassified. Well, let's talk about your Purple Heart. Let's talk about one of the operations where you were wounded. So just kind of set the stage for us. What were you doing? What was the objective? Where were you kind of, what part of the world were you in? What was going on?
So we were based in a country in East Africa. It was from the organization, from the unit. It was three of us. And we had a couple of Navy guys, SEAL team guys, a couple of other agencies guys. And we were using the East African country as a hub for us to go in and out of another country. Basically, to go to Somalia, back home, because this is in the book, to go track Al-Qaeda guys or Al-Shabaab guys in Somalia, back and forth. And we had our own mission, we had our own job, we had our own things to do, and we were getting really, really close to taking some of those guys out. The team we had, we were under a civilian. The team lead was a civilian guy from another government agency. And he, nice guy, but he was very, let's just go to the same place. Life is easy. Life is good. Nothing going to happen. Us as military guys were like, hey, all it takes just one crazy guy to throw a grenade at us and we're fucked. So we ended up going there. And because Somalia was not a declared war zone, we were not authorized to take rifles with us. We were authorized just to take pistols. So our team, me and my buddy who was from my unit was going with me, the two Navy guys, we didn't talk to each other. I mean, I was the team lead from my side. That was a Navy SEAL guy was the lead for his side. We didn't really coordinate with each other. Hey, let's take our M4 and hide our M4s in our backpack. So we were hiding our M4s in our backpack, but we're going on private, semi-private contracted planes to Somalia in and out. And then... We had an ambush, almost an ambush. So they were coming to attack the airfield that we were based out of. And it was literally six of us, two civilian, two Navy, two of us.
How long was this after you had landed? You said you took a semi-charter. How long after you'd landed did this ambush happen?
So we landed, we got really lucky because... again, we were so lucky because these guys were setting us. We used to land in the airfield, and then we would go from the airfield to another location, about 45 minutes drive. So these guys set up an ambush in that route. So we landed, but we had equipment in the field, in the airfield. And I said, guys, we have not maintenance the equipment for a while. Can we just maintenance the equipment? You guys can go and come back. You'll find us here, or we all can wait and go together. So the team lead, the civilian guy, said, no, let's just all wait and go together. The Al-Shabaab guys, they waited and they waited and they waited, and we didn't go. And they were like, these guys are not coming. We'll go to them. So they started moving, and there were a couple of checkpoints there. They ran the checkpoints. That some radio calls went on back and forth. To the guy, we were working with some guys in Somalia, obviously. They were picking us up and like locals who are helping us out. The pilot, who spoke Somali as well, who's like calm as calm can be, never really was, he's local from the region there as well. And he heard the chatter on the radio. And the pilot was like, hey, guys, we need to leave now immediately. And everybody was like, what's going on? He's like, no, we need to leave immediately. So everybody runs to the aircraft. We take our M4s out. We make it to the aircraft. He takes off with, we took the equipment with us, and some of this equipment had some intercepts. And by the time we landed back in the neighboring country, we got the equipment out, we got everything out. And one of the guys that was involved in the ambush, and then they attacked the locals. There was a firefight going on between the locals. We saw that from the aircraft. As we made it back to the neighboring country, we took the equipment out, we took everything out, and then we started listening to the intercepts that we had. And they were like, hey, six white pigs landed, get ready. So they were really preparing for us. And I was like, guys, I'm not white and I'm not a pig. But anyway, we're not going to get upset over that. So, but when we got those intercepts analyzed, one of the guys that was involved was a Somali American guy. So he was a U.S. citizen as well.
One of the guys from the attacker side?
From the attacker side was a U.S. citizen.
Yeah.
So he, we had the FBI guys in the task force. We had a couple of other, like, other agencies there. So they froze the guy's bank account in the U.S. immediately to send a message to him and his family. He had family in the U.S., his family contacted the Somali community in the U.S. You have the Minnesota area. You mentioned that already. And the Somali Americans are in the Silver Spring area a lot, in the College Park, Maryland. There is a big population there as well. So the wife of the attacker, she knows the sister of one of our translators who has TS clearance. The guy's cleared. The guy's good. The guy was like one of us. He was with us and everything. He's the guy translated. So what happened is they contacted him. He works in the embassy. He's in my team. And the wife, who was in the neighboring country at that time, where she went there, she had dinner with our translator. So this is the wife of the terrorist. She had dinner with our translator. The translator, she gave him the number. She's like, hey, my husband would like to talk to somebody from the embassy. And obviously, she's like, hey, my husband would like to talk to somebody from the CIA. So the translator freaked out. This is a Tuesday night. He called me and he's like, are you home? I'm like, yes, I'm home. He didn't tell me what's going on, but he said, I have to come and see you immediately, like now. So he came straight to my house. That was a Tuesday night. As soon as he told me the story, I was like, how do you know you were not followed? He's like, oh, no. I didn't think I was followed. So we don't know till now, was it a trap or not? Was he followed? I mean, what was the deal? But that was Tuesday night. Thursday night, I get ambushed by my house by three guys with guns. As I was coming back to the house in the evening, these guys were waiting. Literally, it's a compound. We were living in a compound, had about like maybe, I don't know, 20 houses or something. My house was about like, 60, 70 meters away from the gate. So if I drive through the gate, there is no way by the time I drive and I park the car, get out of the car, these guys are by my house. They're not that fast. They are not faster than a car. So I think they were inside already waiting. I get out of the car, and as soon as I get out of that door, I hear a gunshot. And the joke here, my abs are made out of steel, so the bullet bounced, so it didn't go through.
Okay, Superman. So
I didn't feel anything. I was like, okay, it's a ricochet. He missed. So we got into this fist fight for about 5-10 minutes maybe. Then the other two guys came. One of them hit me in my chin with the bottom of his gun. Got the other guy off my hands, and then they ran. They took my phone. I didn't have money. So it wasn't a robbery, but they tried to make it seem like a robbery, but they threw my wallet like right around the street, right outside of the gate. So this is the whole thing, that for the gunshot and everything. But my ab is not made out of steel. Actually, the bullet went through. It hit my stomach. It came out of my back. So apparently, whatever that the 300-400 crunches and sit-ups I was doing every day do not stop a bullet. Then a couple of hours after, I'm in a hospital in East Africa.
So to kind of rewind a little bit, I know you won't say who it is, but we have a good idea which three-letter agency this civilian person was from that freaked out. That I don't think I was followed. That's the first red flag. Well, I don't think I was followed. So obviously set up to try and find out. Why did they pick on you? Was it simply because you were a target of opportunity, or do you think you were specifically singled out? Or is it just because this guy, this translator, is the one that calls you and wants to come over and see you? Could it have been somebody else, or do you think you were targeted?
I think it could have been any of our team guys, because I was the senior guy. I was the team leader. So I was his boss. So he contacted me first, and he came to my house.
Okay.
If it wasn't me, I think if it was anybody else in that situation, the same thing could have happened. If they were, again, we don't have any confirmation. This is 100% what happened, but this is the way I analyzed it. What happened and the actions, like, you know, step by step, step by step, step by step, this is what it led to. But it could have been any of the other guys as well.
So what about after this happened? Did you have, was there anybody who went out and looked to determine who the suspects were and apply some level of justice? Or was there any after action taken?
So there was an investigation, obviously. The local police took control of the investigation.
I'm sorry. I've been in many foreign countries. Anytime they say it does not instill confidence. When the local police, I'll tell you a story later about what happened to me in Malaysia. I actually had to conduct the investigation because they weren't going to, but it just does not give me confidence. We say, well, the local police took over. Were they invested? Because here's the reason I say that. I think back, Murph, and to some of the stuff, you know, when you watch on Netflix, but you go back to really what was there, like in Mexico or some other places. It was tough to figure out who was legit and who wasn't legit. You know, who was corrupt, who could you trust? You had your escoltas, you had people who were vetted. But I'm highly suspicious in some of these countries, especially where the level of corruption is where it's at, or the level of penetration by terrorist organizations. So I kind of say that just to say this is, did you have confidence that the local police force was acting in your best interest, or were they just there to cover it up?
No, absolutely not. They were there to cover it up. And obviously I was there in that neighboring country on a diplomatic passport. So I was in a dip status. So that would have made it a big deal if it was not reported as a robbery. So the easiest thing was for the local police to say it's a robbery. The local police did not come to the hospital to question me, to ask me, but they issued a report. It was a robbery. The local police took the whole thing, and the embassy at that time, it was easier for everybody to say this was just a robbery.
Well, we know it's not. So does the story end there, or did you like kind of like Don Corleone, you know, hey, somebody's got to pay for this, or did you just let it go?
Fuck no. I didn't let it go.
All right.
Tell us how you really feel there.
Yeah. So tell us what you can.
So, yes. So basically, it's the other stories in the book as well. So I was at that time, they sent me a U.S. military doctor who, one of the nicest guys on the planet. He just looks so young. And I was like, man, they sent me a kid. I was pissed. And I told him, and he's like, dude, I'm a lieutenant colonel. My son is in college. I was like, okay, I owe you a college. So I went to a local hospital there. Again, I mentioned that in the book, so I'm not going to repeat the story. But basically, then I got flown back to the U.S. About like 3-4 weeks after. I went to Walter Reed for a couple of days. Then I went on recovery. And then they sent me to another mission like 3 months after. Then something else happened, so I put it in the book. And I was like, man, maybe I'm bad luck. So they took me off the road for a year after that. They said, hey, you might want to, like, you are lucky nothing happens to you. You don't die, but people around you get injured as well. So you might just want to just take a year, take a knee and take a year off. So I didn't deploy for a year. Then after that, I went back to East Africa. And at that time, I had the opportunity to leave the army. I was up for reenlistment. In addition to the military doctor who came and visited me, who came and picked me up from Africa. He was like, this can go anywhere you want it, any way you want it. We can get you out of the army on medical retirement, medical discharge, medical retirement. We can board you. we can do it however you want it. I said, Momo, who said I didn't want to leave? So 2 years after I go back to, two years after being shot, I go back to East Africa. And we had an opportunity to go after the head of the Al-Shabaab at that time, who we've been tracking for a while. And this guy, like, we get him, we lose him, we get him, we lose him, we get him, we lose him. We rotate every 3-4 months. That's so the guys, like, you know, they, our team, like, rotates every 3 months, 3-4 months. The guys, they go, they track the guy, they lose the guy. And I just, I was there in April of 2008 with the right attitude, which is being just pissed at all of them. I had the right attitude and I had the right determination. And rather than staying in that neighboring country to go to Somalia, we moved to another neighboring country to allow me to go to Somalia, to be there longer, to do more, to do a lot more things. And we lost some assets. So these other government agencies that you know which one, they took some of our air assets at that time. And the task force commander called me and he's like, hey, man, you don't have what you need. You really don't have what you need. It's your call, but we think you should come back. And it was me and two other guys, a Marine and an Army guy. The Marine was doing something slightly different. The other Army guy was with me. It was his first mission to East Africa. Hispanic American, so he looked like Arab a bit. And I told the task force commander, I said, no, I think we're going to get that head of the organization tonight. So we were
now,
doing,
did you
like,
know that for sure, or were you just pulling it out of your ass at that point?
I was pulling it out of my ass, but I had a very strong gut feelings. And I didn't want to be like, you know, this guy who's like, you know, has a relationship with God and God is telling him. But I really had that feeling like tonight, it's going to be the night. So I told the task force commander and he's like, okay, I trust you. I trust you. Do whatever you think is right and go for it. And I was sick. I was coughing. I had some allergy, I think, from the dust in Africa. They gave me some cortisone shots to calm the coughing down. Then me and this other guy went that night. I think we went around. And I picked the time to be there because of the times of the prayers. So I was like, okay, if he has to wake up in the morning to do the morning prayer, so I need to get there. We need to get there around that, before that time, so we can really get what we need to go after him. So my analysis were right, that he's going to be up and moving and doing things at that time. So I think we sent the grid coordinates around 4 o'clock in the morning, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And I think I was in E6, E7 at that time. So here I am, like a poor kid from Egypt who gonna send the grid coordinates to have $4-5 million worth of TLAMs, that's a missile, to destroy that guy's compound, him and whoever else is there. So again, yes, was I angry that I got shot 2 years before? Yeah, absolutely. But was I cautious not to go after innocent people? Absolutely. Not just me cautious, the task force was cautious, the US government was cautious. I know people don't believe that we pay attention to those things and we pay attention to civilians, and we do actually. So we did everything right to send those grid coordinates, and I did get pictures of the compound before and after, and that's when I felt now I can heal my wound.
So the before and after picture, the after picture, I'm assuming it's open for new development, right? So now you can build new things on it?
You will may have to put a lot of dirt in the ground to start building things.
Hey, well, let me go back a little bit and ask you about that. Because you mentioned something I think people need to be very clear about, that they think that we don't care about civilians or that we kind of pay it lip service. There's actually a ratio they look at in warfare. They look at military deaths versus civilian deaths, and they look at that ratio to say, you know, is it too far out of, because unfortunately in war, civilians get killed. Do you do what you can to keep them from getting killed? When you decided to send those, the targeting package, you've got the grid coordinates. So in law enforcement, we have levels of proof. Like reasonable suspicion is like just enough to stop somebody. You think they're up to something, but you don't have any proof, but they have enough indicators. Probable cause to arrest means, hey, would a reasonable person believe that you're about to commit a crime? And then you go to trial, and then it has to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Not beyond all doubt, but beyond a reasonable doubt. So if you kind of take those levels of proof, when you send in that targeting package, those grid coordinates, and you know that you're about to send stuff downrange that's going to blow big holes, what's your level of confidence at that point? Like if this were a criminal trial, are you firmly convinced that you're proof beyond a reasonable doubt at that point that the dude is there, the conditions are right, or do you have to take a calculated risk?
Actually, for this one, no, for him, it was 100%. We had 100%. I had 100% proof he's there. We had different sources that validated that. So we had three different ints. So the three different intelligence capability providing that he's there. The only calculated risk that I took was how many civilians might be there. And the only civilian that was there was his wife. We killed 10 people at that night or that day because it was super early in the morning. One wife and 8 terrorist guys involved with him in the Al-Qaeda East Africa or Al-Shabaab at that time. The wife was the only one. And then I made it back to, we made it back out and it was in TV and you needed that validation. So the spokesperson of Al-Shabaab talked to BBC in that morning and he said, Aiden Ira has been killed. So that was the biggest validation that we got. And then I was sitting in a, this is just off. I'm sitting in the dining facility and in that country we were at. It was like a military base there as well, small military base. And it's on TV and some young soldier was like, yeah, fuck yeah, I hope we kill all Muslims. And I wanted to go and tell the guy, like, by the way, I was the guy behind the mission and I'm Muslim myself. But you don't say anything. And that's honestly where the quiet professionalism come from. You just don't say anything. You smile and you move on and you go to the next target. But there are more details we put in the book in this one, and it's been cleared. Obviously, we changed some of the. So for the people who like, oh, this doesn't make perfect sense. No, we changed some of the stuff to protect sources and methods. During the ambush, actually, two years earlier during the ambush, the local, we called them militia, honestly. The local militias, they were working with us and helping us. They got in a firefight with Al-Shabaab guys, and one of the guys lost his eye. And literally, I bullshit you not, the week after when we went again, that's basically the night I got shot. When we went that morning, we were in Somalia that morning as well, if I missed to mention. The guy had like a cow's eye, like eyeball, like in his eye socket. And I know some people said this is not possible. They were not using medical to make the guy see. It's just something to make the guy look like he has an eye.
But symmetry,
they cleaned it with whatever they cleaned it with, and they put something there.
Hey, let's talk about once you send that, once you know that ordinance is going downrange and you reach the point of no return. You know, people, so like in law enforcement or military, especially if you're infantry and stuff, right? You are seeing the eyes of the people you're dealing with. So like if you get into a shootout, like, you know, you were talking about Murph or other folks, you're in contact with these people. Now you're sending stuff downrange where you don't see anything. Does that make it less difficult to deal with? I mean, how do you deal with that, you know, as a military professional? Once you know that you've done your job, you send it downrange. Just like we've talked to many cops on here, and even Kevin Holland, you know, you do your job. You don't feel bad about doing your job. Sometimes you have survivor's guilt, like if your partner dies or, you know, somebody else happens. How do you deal with the fact that, you know, you're sending ordnance downrange and in just a matter of minutes, 10 people are going to be gone?
So a couple of things. We had the capability of diverting the missile up to like 5 minutes before it hits target. So we wanted to make sure the guy is in that location till then. And then if you get the chance, the listeners get the chance to read the book, they'll see what the guy done by torturing people, by killing people who he was. This guy went from killing nuns to killing nurses to So you gotta be able to live with justice. You are actually delivering justice. It's not easier or harder if you see a guy in the face and you shoot him or not. It's the same. To me, it was the same. If that guy had the chance to kill me, he would have killed me, whether I was in front of him or I was 10 miles away, or if he had the chance to blow up.
Send somebody with a bomb strapped to them to go blow you up, he would have done it.
Or send somebody with a gun to shoot me by my house, or send somebody with a gun to shoot somebody else, or any of those things. So for somebody to go and say, well, this is it's sanitized war because we don't see the guy eye to eye, I disagree with it 100%. You still have, at least for me and for the guys they were with me at that time, for the team, we had the same responsibility. Believe it or not, I needed to do one thing once to get confirmation for the grid coordinates. I did it 3 times. And I'm not going to say what I was doing to get the confirmation, but I could have given the confirmation of the grid coordinate most likely 45 minutes to an hour earlier without taking any more risk on myself or my team. I could have done that. No, I went above and beyond to make sure that this is the right grid coordinates. This is the right location. This is the right guy. Everything was the right thing to get done. So we took it extremely seriously.
Well, even being 100% sure, even after you know it fires off, the weapon is headed downrange, do you still wonder, have I done everything I can? Or are you satisfied at that point? I've done everything I can. Everything is legit. Is there any nagging doubt, or are you like 100% committed? This, you know, we're good.
Honestly, that was nagging until we got the confirmation on the radio that he was there. So again, you needed that extra validation, I guess. So till the spokesperson of Al-Shabaab in the morning had a press release or something on BBC where he said Aiden Iroh was killed. And here is just, he said him and 9 other people. So him, 8 other males affiliated with the organization and 1 female. And the guy said, actually, or the people in the area said the female body was the only body that was not burned. Everybody else's body was burned. And I was like, well, maybe there is justice. I mean, maybe God gave her an easy way out. She didn't get burned like the rest of them.
Yeah. Hey, funny you should mention that. The reason I asked that is, let me put it, you might see this. I don't know how well you can see this. This is a challenge coin. It came from CENTCOM.
Yeah, I can see it.
Yeah. During 2012, I was the senior law enforcement advisor for the Republican National Convention down in Tampa. And one of the things they did is they brought us out to MacDill, which is where CENTCOM's located at. And they brought us into what's called the FPOC, you know, and they say, hey, you know, they're giving us a tour. Part of this was classified. So, you know, we're getting a look at it. And he says, I want to do something else. This was not on the schedule. We're like, okay, we're good. He takes us into what's called the CPOC. I think it's the Central Point of Command. And he brings us in. There's this little room and this little table. And he hits a button, and out of that table rises up a bank of phones. And I start getting the idea. So it's kind of like, this is where they launched Operation Neptune Spear from, to go get bin Laden. And I said, which phone? He points at it. So I touched the phone. And so for like 6 months, I didn't wash my finger. Like, hey, smell this. This is the smell of freedom.
You know? That's gross.
No, but the reason I say that is we know from history, from that this went all the way to the White House. The authorities had to go all the way to the White House to take out bin Laden for a couple of reasons. Number one, we're going into Pakistan. You know, it's there's different types of missions. They call them Title 10 missions and Title 50 missions. So technically, SEAL Team 6 DEVGRU was operating under the authorities of CIA because this was an intelligence mission. For what the work that you guys were doing, how far up the chain of command do you have to go when you guys do an operation like that? Maybe not this specific one, but like when you're sending ordnance like that downrange, you're going to take out 10 people. How far up the chain of command do you have to go to get approval, to get your, you know, for authority to be able to operate that mission? Does it things like that go to the White House for targeted people like this, or does that happen at a lower level?
No, so a couple of things. So we were operating under CIA authority as well, because it was an intel mission. However, for those, so if there is a mosque It's presidential authority. It's presidential approval. So during that time, during the time I was there, if there is a, if we hit in a mosque, taking somebody out in a mosque, it was presidential approval. For non-mosque, for a situation like this, it was SecDef approval. So obviously we wouldn't go. It was it would go to JSOC commander, and JSOC commander would be like, yeah, it's a go or no go. And obviously he would get a go or no go after getting the approval of SecDef. That's to my knowledge. So that the day before, we had I wasn't on that target for a week before we executed the target.
For our listeners that just heard SecDef, that's Secretary of Defense.
Yep, thank you. So I was there for about a week before we executed the target. I wanted to say like from two nights before that we hit the target. We had the approval if certain criterias have been met. The certain criterias I cannot say the criterias, but there was three criterias that we had to meet. And if we've met those criterias, you have to the embassy where we were based out of in the neighboring country, the ambassador had to be briefed, the chief station had to be briefed, the task force commander was doing that. And again, the task force commander had direct contact with, at that time, JSOC commander was General McChrystal. So it was, we had to go up the chain of command and we had to get the right approvals before we threw $5 million worth of missiles.
Well, and it's the value of the ordnance that's going downrange too, but it's the authority and it's making sure that, hey, look, people, I think the reason I wanted to go into a little more detail on this is because sometimes people think it's just willy-nilly, it's John Wayne. Hey, there's a bad guy, fire a missile. Before you fire a missile, there's a lot of shit that's got to go on and a lot of approval. I mean, I think back to the operational plans, even you were talking about, Murph, that you guys had to put together the op plans, you know, which you learned were very important after Kevin Stevens, right? Let's pull together a op plan. But I mean, but just the planning alone. It sometimes takes more time than the actual mission itself.
Absolutely. Actually, the planning for this mission took a lot of time. And again, you had to move an aircraft carrier to near enough to have those missiles, to fire those missiles, to hit this target, to hit this location. You got to realize that we are there on our own. So it was me and another guy, just it was two of us. There is a lot of planning, a lot of talks, a lot of like, hey, if you feel, task force commander honestly was like, hey, if you feel uncomfortable, just don't do it. So there is you have a lot of responsibility and a lot of authority, but it's not let's just kill this bad guy. It's not for missions like this. Obviously, if you are somewhere and you are in a you have the war zones. If I'm in Iraq and I'm getting a firefight, I'm not going to ask somebody for an approval to shoot somebody. The ambush that we were going into, if we were not lucky and we got into it, I wasn't going to keep my M4. And no, we had and by the way, we had all that when we pulled our equipment out, I mean, the four of us had the same exact gears, like us and the SEAL team guys had the same exact things, just the two other agency guys did not have. And I think I said it in the book, so I'll just say it was like two CIA guys and one of them was wearing fucking sandals. Which pissed me off.
Yeah. Hard to run in those sandals. It was. Yeah. You do have that in the book.
Yeah. Hey, and kind of final piece to tie off on that, because like I said, we already went like at almost 90 minutes the first time, and now we're coming up on an hour this time, so we want to make good use of your time. But it's now, when you fired this off, did this come from an aircraft carrier or did it come from a battleship?
It came from a battleship.
Yeah. The reason I ask that is that you're talking about there's a lot of equipment and personnel on station, you know, out there. So for you, it's like knowing that you got it right, making sure all this stuff is vectored in, having the ships where you need them, having the people where you need them, the entire ecosystem, you know, up and down the thing. It's like you're juggling 10 balls in the air and two of them are yours at this point, pal, you know, trying to keep everything going.
By the way, so we had to talk to the QRF before we go, so the Quick Reaction Forces, just in case something happened to us. And you have to be able for the QRF, if God forbid something happened and they have to come and get us, they were in another country. They were not even in the same country we were in. So it was going to take them some time to fly to get us. We have to go. And this was the thing that I had to always tell people. By the way, guys, I am an American soldier. I might don't look like one. Don't think every guy is a blonde guy, blue eyes. So we had to go. We had to be in all of these coordinations to make sure, just in case something bad happens, these guys can come and get us.
Point to your face and you go, friendly guys, I'm a friendly.
Exactly. We had money just in case that we have to buy our safety out. We had our go bag, had a lot of things. We have an American flag with like in the four corners of the American flags. I don't know if you guys ever seen it. It's called Bloodshed. And every corner of those four corners had a number on it. And in case somebody you are in dire need and somebody can help you to get out of harm's way, you can give him a piece of that flag. And this is a hard paper. It's like money paper. That guy can take it to any embassy and they'll reward him. So we had all of these things. We have sensitive items. We had tons of things that we had to be careful that not to to misuse them or to lose them. So yes, you have to juggle all of these things to be able to accomplish the mission.
And in that part of the world, the quick reaction force, the QRF, was that could you say, was that Rangers? Was that Navy? Or did it depend upon which area in the world you were in, who the QRF was?
We were stretched very thin at that time. It was the Guam National Guard.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow. And Guam still would have taken a while to get there, right? So you guys are going to have to figure out how to fight your way out, how to exfil, yourself out.
They were based nearby, but they were based a good 2 hours flight.
Okay.
But they had the Guam National Guard based about 2 hours away. Oh, yeah,
but
yeah.
That's
100%.
But that's 2 hours once they're in the air, right? You still got to get people together, get them, get everything staged and get them on there. So you might be looking at 3 hours if you're lucky.
This, honestly, any of those missions.
Were they already prepped, ready to go?
They were not ready. No, we had to do things. But on any of those missions, when we were going on them, General McChrystal, in one of his briefings to us, he's like, just to let you guys know, like, when you are there, you are in your own, basically. And if you don't want to go, don't go. But so basically, when you go to those missions, you are in your own. Whether it was in this mission or I deployed 14 times in 10 years, in any deployment, in Iraq, I used to go out of the green zone on my own, driving a local car. If I'm out of the base, I am on my own 100%. They were not. If somebody shoots you in the face, that you're done. So you have to be super careful.
Got to have your head on a swivel. Hey, last thing before we kind of close out here. The other thing you said, you did like 3 to 4 months rotation, and then the other people would come in. Was that simply because of what they call the op tempo, the operational tempo? You guys were operating so fast, so hard the whole time that about after 3 or 4 months, you really needed a break.
Correct. And our break sometimes was, our break was not 2-3 months either. Sometimes you were back home for a month or 2 months and you would deploy again. But yeah, the op tempo was very, very high. You are in a mission where you're not sleeping much. You're not, you're heading the swivel 24/7, honestly. So yes, I don't think any, and by the way, it was the same rotation cycle for Delta and SEAL team. It was 3-4 months rotations. None of the JSOC guys deployed for a year.
So when you decided to punch out, you said, this is it, I'm retiring. How long did it take you to decompress, to get to the point of where you weren't on that? Not that you don't have some level of alert, I know, especially when you're in a foreign country, but when you're back in the United States, let's say, how long did it take you to get to the point to where you could be comfortable being home? You could be comfortable knowing that, hey, hopefully a bad guy, a Somali, is not about to jump a fence, and try and shoot me and rob me. But how long did it take you to decompress, to kind of get down, lower your own personal op tempo, or that adrenaline that's always seems to be pumping when you're at condition yellow, most of the time?
So I, again, we've been talking a lot about this lately within the community, about like what's called operator syndrome. I don't think you ever I mean, you are a guy who's going from zero to hero all the time. You are a guy in alert all the time. You are a guy who's like, if you're running, you got to run fast. If you're walking, you got to walk fast. If you're doing a mission, you got to check everything. You got to check everything like once and twice. If you pack in, you pack two things because two is one and one is none. So you can't pack one thing. So that becomes like part of your DNA. So I'm not sure if you don't go back to normal. That's what I wanted to tell everybody. You don't go back to normal. If you think you are normal, you're not normal. And that's why we talked about this. We've been talking about this operator syndrome lately. It's not, I don't think it's PTSD. I don't think it's the trauma. It's basically you are a guy, you have this adrenaline going on for 10 years. And then there is no button to turn it off and on. So that's what I hope, like, you know, the JSOC community, the SOCOM community, the VA is doing a better job now than when I retired. Because when I retired and I went to the VA guy and he looks at me in uniform and he's like, this is a psychologist in the VA. I didn't say anything. I did not claim PTSD. I did not file for any of this. I just, you know, the gunshot wound. I have two surgeries in my legs, a surgery in my elbow, a surgery in my back. I mean, just the surgeries. And this guy was like, hey, Sergeant Major, tell your soldiers not to try to fake PTSD. So if I was going to even tell him I do have an issue, right there, he turned me off. So I think we ought to do a better job. I hope they are doing a better job now than when I retired. I'm not doing this. I'm not asking for any help for myself or support. I'm totally good. But I've seen general officers taking their own lives away in the last few years. Is there a switch that it gets on and off? I don't know. I don't think so. But I don't think you ever go back to normal 100%. Because, and we can go on and on to tell you why, but I'll leave this to another interview maybe.
Well, go ahead, Murph, because I have a question about that.
I was just going to say, a few weeks ago, I went and supported a military appreciation weekend up in Beaufort, South Carolina, where there were a lot of MARSOC, a lot of special operators there from the military. I've never seen that many service dogs in one gathering in my life. And I was the keynote speaker, and you know, I started off in a situation like that where I'm telling you, why is there a retired cop up here talking to all you veterans? You know, and it comes from my background of having worked with different military units over the years with DEA. And it just, you know, the Narcos thing gives me a little bit of credibility. It gives you a little bit of recognition so that people will at least listen to you. But at the end, I always talk about what is it we as American citizens can do for you guys who risk your own lives for us? And, you know, I'm seeing these service dogs. I'm seeing you guys and getting in groups and talking to each other. Just yesterday, and I know that this won't relate to when we release your podcast, but just yesterday I went and joined the U.S. Marine Corps Scout Sniper Association for a fundraiser in Orlando here, or over in Orlando. And these guys, when you come up and they find out that you're there to support them, they wrap their arms around you. But one of the things, and I'm talking to them, is what are your feelings about the VA? Because the VA hospital in Orlando is one of the most modern structures I've ever seen in my life. It's a beautiful building. But, you know, both situations here recently, I said, how's the VA working for you? And man, I thought they were going to throw shit at me, you know, when I was up on stage talking to them. And when I mentioned that yesterday, the guy said, hey, don't put too much credit in the VA. You know, they're still not where they need to be. And it's a little bit off topic, but it fits right in with the situation you're in. You got the freaking people that are supposed to help you telling you, tell your guys don't be putting in for PTSD. Well, if you've got that issue, you got that issue. Telling them not to do it's not going to make it go away. So you outlined very well in your book how when, because of what you did in the military, your record is scrubbed, and you have to go in and justify to the people that you're asking help from why you need help, and they're looking at your record going, there's nothing in here. So I like your recommendations in the book about, you know, there should be one person who has access to your records that can alleviate those issues and can guarantee that you or whoever gets the help they need. But there's no more important issue, in my opinion, in the country that if we're not taking our veterans seriously and taking care of them, that shit needs to change, and it needs to change now. If that requires all of us calling our legislators and jumping up and down on the phone with them or going into their damn office, well, you don't want to go in their office because you get
no, you can go into the office. Just don't jump up and down on their desk when you're in the office. That's the.
Yeah.
But it's, and I, we're making a little bit light of it here, but that's, I mean, I'm 100% supporter behind this. We need to do everything we can to make sure our veterans get the best freaking care, the housing they need, whatever it is they need. You stepped up to the plate, you know, you risk your own life to protect me. I was never in the military. Morgan was. I can't thank you guys enough, but it's time that we really take this shit serious.
So while we're talking about this, honestly, because I don't want to close this in a good way of like people need to understand. I don't have the exact percentage. We do have soldiers, lower enlisted soldiers on food stamps. We should be ashamed of ourselves if we have our service members, men and women on food stamps. We should be ashamed of that as the richest country in the world. That's one thing. The second thing, when you are a veteran or a retiree, if you go to a military installation for medical support, you are in the back of the line. 2 months before, when you were a guy still in the service, you were in front of the line. Well, you should be ashamed of that medical facility. You should be ashamed of not giving that veteran the support they needed. And for the American people, there are less than 2.5% of Americans that serve in the military. Again, I'm not. I'm honored. I tell everybody. I was very lucky to be able to serve. But what people don't realize, when you see me in uniform and you tell me thank you for your service, I do it. I tell people, thank you for allowing me to serve. But what people don't realize that these guys went fought wars, especially we've been at war for 20 years. The longest war in our history, a lot of people didn't know that. And then they expect you that when you come back, you should be very normal because you were doing their dirty work for them, right? But you should be very normal. So when you're not, and again, normal is a relative term here, but we have a lot of people, they don't even want to work with military people. So like, oh man, these special operation guys are crazy. Are they just going to come and yell at people? And I'm like, guys, you've been telling that guy yelling at people is the right thing for the last 20 plus years. So how do you expect him to turn it on and off without taking him through the right process? Then they have this soldier for life or TAP or whatever transition system they have in place. So I go and I attend this for a week. And they tell you, this is how you can find a job. This is how you can do it. They try to do their best in doing that. But we have a lot of work to do. We cannot be going to the VA and the VA doctors looking at us as their enemies. Because that's the situation. Like, that's what everybody tells you. When you go and just be careful. If the guy notices that you can bend over and tie your shoes, then maybe you don't have an issue with your back. I'm like, dude, it's that day that I went, I'm feeling okay. But tomorrow when I wake up in the morning, I'm not feeling okay. So believe me, I'm not lying. If I served and you told me integrity is one of the basic foundations of the Army, then you should believe me. But I'm not, I didn't want to end it in a bad note or I'm angry, but I think the VA should do a lot.
No. Hey, brother, right there with you. My son-in-law was a Marine formerly on active duty, actually served under Mattis overseas. And he has lost, I mean, when he wanted to marry my daughter, him and I had a come to Jesus talk. And it was one of those things that, look, I've lost more friends to suicide than I have in line of duty. I know, Murph, you've lost friends to suicide. You know, suicide is one of the leading causes of deaths for service members. But him and I had a talk. I said, I want to know where your head is. I mean, I was very direct with him. I said, you're not marrying my daughter only to turn around and leave her a widow in 2 years. You know, but to his credit, he's one of the guys, he could get some service. I mean, his gunny was blown up in front of him, stepped on an IED, lost his legs. He lost guys in combat. He's eligible for stuff. His mentality is, I don't want to do, because it'll take away from the people who really need it. And that's part of the challenge we have dealing with a lot of folks in the military too. It's like, they're deserving of care, but they're continue the mission mindset. I'll take care of my buddy. It's the guy on your left. It's the guy on the right. That's the ones you care about. You know, we've got to get to that point too, where it's okay to say, raise your hand and say, hey, I need some help. Because that is, every now and then somebody will post a video and you'll see a trooper, or a cop, somebody who is also in the military approach a guy who's, one guy was on the phone with the suicide hotline, a veteran, and he's talking him out of stuff. And so, no, Adam, I mean, you nailed it. Here's a novel idea. If you're a politician and you're listening, what chances are you're not because you don't like us. But if you're listening, I have a novel idea. Rather than giving $5,000 a month to immigrants, illegal immigrants who come into this country, let's give $5,000 a month to people who are living on food stamps right now, serving in the military. Let's take care of them first. Let's get them housing first. And what we have left over, I'm more than happy to help people, you know, because I still care at heart. But you know what I care about? I care that you came from Egypt because I'm a big fan of culture, but I don't care that you came from Egypt because my thing is when you raised your right hand and you said, I do, and you put on the uniform, brother, that's all it took for me. At the end of the day, when you cut us, we all bleed red. It doesn't matter where you came from. Everybody's got red on the inside. Sorry, another, I told you I wouldn't do rants and I just did another one. Damn it.
No, but honestly, I think you stole my line because I used to tell everybody, if everybody bleeds red, so we all have the same blood color. We all have the same needs. We all have the same ambition in life. We all want it to do well. Some people do it different ways than others. Some people work harder than others. But the VA really need to do something. And I have tons of recommendations for them. But I don't think they want to listen.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know we can't solve it on this, and there's podcasts and other people out there who are really focusing on that, so we'll do that. Well, let's do this. Let's end in a very positive way. So first of all, by the way, when you look in the book too, I was kidding him after Murph got snatched and he was being renditioned. We had a talk. I pulled up, and you've got some pictures of yourself in the book, and I said, son, that is a lot of fruit salad on the chest. So if you folks look, you take a look at the service ribbons. You know, you think about this. Here's a kid. 21 years old, comes over from Egypt, doesn't know English, puts yourself through English school, joins the military. And then when you retire, how many years did you have in when you punched out?
21.
When you take a look at what's on that left chest, out of all of those things on the left side of your Class A's, what are the two or three things that you're most proud of? All the service ribbons or the qualifications, or what are you most proud of?
So the military free fall, just jumping out of an airplane, something I'm extremely proud of.
With a parachute, I assume?
With the parachute, yes. There is a combat action badge. That's for people who are in firefights or in close combat. So the combat action badge, that's another one. And the Bronze Stars. I have, I think... And please don't caught me in the. It's either three or four Bronze Stars. I think three Bronze Stars, because a lot of people know Bronze Star is. Although the LOM, the Legend of Merit, and the Purple Heart are higher than the Bronze Star, but the Bronze Star meant a lot to me because it was for very specific missions and very specific locations that made me very proud to serve.
And what you did with your Bronze Stars, and there's a photograph in there, very moving.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes. And I did the same thing for the Purple Heart, by the way. So I gave, I framed the Purple Heart, gave it to my wife, and I had two daughters. Each one of them got a Bronze Star from a mission that I was deployed when something significant was happening for her, with her. Obviously, we missed a lot of birthdays and a lot of first day of school, a lot of Ramadans, Christmas. We celebrate Christmas as well. So a lot of people just like, oh, we did miss Christmases as well and New Year's. And a lot of service members do. And again, my fear is a lot of people are forgetting. During the global war on terrorism, service members were deploying left and right. I mean, we deployed more than ever, I think, in our history.
And the families took a big hit too. Like you say, you know, if it wasn't for strong families, it would be very difficult for you to go downrange and do what you need to do.
Correct.
Right. Correct. You know, and not to mention you attained the highest enlisted rank that's out there, command sergeant major. There's not very many of those in the U.S. Army. So the fact that you attained that highest rank, that says volumes about your commitment right there.
Yeah, not bad for an admin clerk. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Not bad. No, not bad for a guy who came to the U.S. not speaking English. How about that?
Yeah. Didn't that what you said, what you started off your initial MOS, wasn't it administration?
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why you can't get any help at the VA. They look and say, well, you're an administrative guy. Paper cut. What else?
And honestly, some of the locations I was assigned at So when you go to the VA, and the VA is like, all of these guys assigned to these locations are guys just sitting behind desks. So when you go tell the VA, like, hey, I have a gunshot wound, then they're like, well, you got it, like, I'm not going to say the city, but they one of them was like, oh, you got it in downtown, and he named the city in the East Coast in the U.S. And I was like, no, actually, I got it downrange. But those are the things. The other thing, honestly, I wanted to mention to you, not just the VA, but even our community, like how people are, like, you know, a guy like me writes a book and everybody's like, well, these guys just trying to make money from the book. It's when I'm like, I wanted people to start thinking larger and bigger. There is a message in the book. There is more of like, I'm really trying to show, here's a story, and we're still protecting national security interests. And we're trying to tell everybody, like, there are people who look different than you. They're still serving. So don't look at them any less than you look at yourself. In addition to that, as an immigrant and as a veteran, I am, and I already donated some of the proceeds from the book, but some of the proceeds from the book going to an immigrant supporting organization. We're still looking for one. We contacted a couple of them. Unfortunately, they didn't answer us yet. There is a vet supporting organization that gives a lot of scholarships to veterans and to kids of veterans. That's who I'm donating money to.
Well, because of the very last sentence of your book, you're not taking credit. My story is about the American dream. I mean, that's what this is. It's an American success story. It's that simple, but getting to that was very complicated.
Yeah. And I knew it was always your dream to be on Game of Crimes podcast. And now your dream has come true, Adam.
There you go. Life's complete.
Woo-hoo! There you go.
Woo-hoo! Hey, well, let's do this. We have cannibalized your time.
Yes.
You've given us a lot of your time because, like I said, Murph got snatched, then he got unsnatched. We had to do some additional recording. So want to thank you for doing that. And folks, you got to go out and get it. Oops, I just put my book over here.
Yeah, this is, and we recommend every book, every guest we have on the show that has a book, we highly recommend it. But this one, if you're interested in what's really going on out there, it's not going to uncover. I read some of the reviews on Amazon about your book. You're not going to give up, you know, the country's secrets here. So don't expect that in the book. But if you want to read something about sacrifice and working towards a goal and coming to the United States and taking advantage of the opportunities that are here, this is the freaking book, man. This is one of the most motivational books I've ever read. I love it very much, and thank you very much for writing it.
So you folks got to go get it. It's called The Unit, My Life Fighting Terrorists as One of America's Most Secret Military Operatives. By the way, we did breaks. Like I said, he gave us exclusive breaking news on here about the gunshot that led to the Purple Heart and the event around that. So we've got to stuff, but Adam wrote it with a nice lady named Kelly Kennedy, who was also in the military, and she's written some other books. So you got to get it now. Folks, you can find this. I mean, just go to Amazon, go to any place that sells books, you know, Barnes and Noble, wherever it is, just get the book, read it. Now, have you set up a website yet? Because I know you're on Twitter, or what they call X now. So you're on X. Have you got a website set up for the book yet, or are you still thinking about that?
So we haven't set up a website yet, but I wanna mention something what Steve said before I get to that website. So those reviews, Steve, in the beginning, honestly, I've read a few of them. I'm a guy who's very level-headed, so I'm not putting a lot into those reviews. I can see some anger or some people like, you know, he should have said more secrets. I rather maintain my integrity than putting out more secrets and selling books. And again, the book is not, it's not a political book. It's more of my story, my opinion, my views. And at the same time, I fought to allow everybody to say his views. So I think I've earned the right to say my views as well. But we have not set up a website yet. I'm thinking about it seriously, but I wanted to check with the publisher first, honestly, how does this work? But
well, you've got some good folks you work with. And look, if you're on, go over on X, formerly known as Twitter, and look for The Unit _ Gamal, G-A-M-A-L, or just look for Adam Gamal. And that'll pull up. You got to go follow him. And here's the thing. Nobody has ever erected a statue to a critic. You know, so fuck the critics, you know, is my thing. You write the book. Here's the thing, though. You wrote the book. You got clearance to write the book. They could have stopped you from writing this book. They could have invoked, you know, one of 100 ways to do this. but you got the book out because I think we got to tell the stories of America's success. And one of our stories of success is people who come to this country like you and do it the right way, live the American dream. And now you've got these things to show for it, which is the opportunity to write a book. So go get it. The Unit, My Life Fighting Terrorists, is one of America's most secret military operatives. Anywhere they sell books, you can find it on Al Gore's amazing internet. It's just out there. Look for The Unit, Adam Gamal, and buy it. And if you don't buy it, we can't be friends. That's, I'm just ending with that, okay?
Well, thank they you. Might think that that's not a big deal, Morgan.
Well, considering I only have two friends, yeah.
I'm gonna start putting some good. It's very small. Obviously, X or Twitter doesn't give you a lot of room to put things, but I'll give some hints of some missions without breaking any rules, obviously. So yeah, if people follow there us on Twitter, that would be great. They'll get more of me.
Hey, last thing too, is that you on the front cover, or did you hire a stand-in for that?
It's not me. So if people think, oh, these guys like trying to look cool, it's absolutely not me. This is,
I was going to say that Kevlar helmet isn't what they're, that's an old style too, man. Is that what you wore?
That's not what we were using, honestly. We were using cooler things. It's just like I said, people have their own ideas, their own image, but we had somebody who designed that cover they showed it to me and I loved it.
Hey, this looks good. Looks good. All right. Well, look, this is us saluting you, saying thank you for your service to our great country. And I know, seriously, we mean it. We mean it. We're going to hang on here for you. Don't go anywhere, because we're going to hang on for a little bit and talk to you about how to blow up your book sales and how to do it with semi-naked photos of yourself in uniform. No, I'm sorry. That's the Air Force. I'm sorry. I had the wrong branch. Sorry. Wrong branch, Air Force, or Navy. I'm not sure which one. But hey, no, we want to talk to you about that. But hey, you guys, go get the book, follow him on X, and support him and support what these folks are doing. So don't go anywhere, Adam. Again, us thanking you. Thanks for being here. Everybody else, stay tuned for the debrief. Remind me not to rob a bank with you, Murph. I told you the name of the podcast was classified. I even redacted it, and you went on and said Game of Crimes. Well, shit, now I did it too.
Well, now we're going to be cellmates.
No, we're not.
I'm going to pimp you out, I'm telling you right now.
And if we are, I'm sleeping with my back to the wall, pal. And I don't play the drop the rope, you know, soap on a rope. I've seen that before. Not going to work again.
I understand.
But by the way, you guys can't see this, but this is us saluting you, Adam, and saluting everybody in this, in our military, you know, all of our first responders. But for those people operating in tier one groups that are out there, that are out there doing things that nobody will ever hear about, you never hear about the successes. We only tend to hear about the failures. But for every failure, there's dozens and dozens of successes. But the one he could talk about, taking out the head of Al-Shabaab, you know, and you think about what it is they did and how they did it, man, that takes some stones.
You know, and just in case you missed this, there's things that we're never going to know about. We're never going to know the particulars, but he puts in his book, and we mentioned it in his interview, that during his time in Africa, they stopped between 30 and 40 terrorist attacks planned against the United States. That means inside our country. And then they stopped another 50 plus terrorist attacks in other parts of the world, just in a matter of a few years. So, you know, when it's easy to sit back and criticize, oh, you know, well, the Secretary of Defense forgot to call the president when he went to the hospital. You know, let's fire his ass. Well, we got all these other things on his mind. You think that might have been a second thought? He probably thought his secretary is going to take care of it. I'm not defending the guy. I'm just saying there's shit going on that we don't know about that is being used to protect us in our own country. For those of you who have never visited outside the United States or have never lived outside the United States and you want to criticize how bad it is to live in the United States, go live in another country for a year or two and then come back and tell us what you think.
Yes.
It's still, we're not perfect. We don't profess to be perfect. We're better than anything else that's out there.
But it is the best system of government. And that's why you've got people like Adam who come here, who did it the right way. And he talks about that. We discussed that. We even have a good discussion at the beginning where we all have different points of view. We disagree, but we're respectful about it. We talk about he talks about the Muslim Brotherhood, which originated in Egypt, 1929, Hassan al-Banna, you know, and talks about his view of it. and why, you know, and why he thinks it's dangerous. So, I mean, just guys, just great stuff, but you got to go get it. And we actually, yesterday, Murph, not being recorded, but we sat with him for another, I think, another almost hour. 90 minutes. Yeah, yeah. An hour, 90 minutes. And work with him to identify, hey, here's some opportunities. Here's what you ought to do. So, you know, he's working on some stuff. But we worked with him about how to do some additional marketing and stuff like that. But you guys, you can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any place that sells books.
Yeah.
He's also got a Twitter account. So you can find him on there. I'll put that in the show notes too. But it's called The Unit, My Life Fighting Terrorists as One of America's Most Secret Military Operatives by Adam Gamal with Kelly Kennedy. And Kelly, thank you to you. I reached out to her first. She put us in touch with Adam and we worked it from there. But I did reach out to Kelly on Proton Mail, kept everything secret out of the eyes of the NSA because I don't know who's still looking for this guy.
Well, they probably are looking for him now because you just said it.
Well, I did tell you where he was. And by the way, when we did talk with him, I won't tell you where he was, but I will tell you it was far enough away that we had a little bit of a lag on our video link. So,
yeah, and he wouldn't tell us anything. And we didn't ask.
We didn't ask. We don't want to know.
Yeah. But this is what I love about Game of Crimes, because we are bringing the untold stories here where we don't tell you what happened. We bring the people that actually lived it. And you get to hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So that's what I love so much about this show.
Yeah. Speaking of horses.
No, I didn't say horse's ass.
You're close enough, though. I knew what you meant. I don't know what you said, but I know what you meant. All right. Guys, hopefully, if you enjoyed that, head on over to Apple, Spotify, hit those 5 stars, put your comments in there, let us know what you think. Support Adam, buy his book, The Unit. Like I say, you can find it everywhere. Follow him on Twitter. Give him some good feedback. Head on over to GameOfCrimesPodcast.com. We've got his book listed there, along with pictures. And a couple exclusive ones that are not in the book. So he WhatsApped those to me from I don't know where, and I will not tell you even if I did know. You're going to have to torture me, you know. Well, Murph, if you just threaten to be in a cell with me, I'll tell you anything you want to know. I don't want you in a cell with me, dude. Anyway, follow us on that thing they call social media, at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. But where you got to be is patreon.com/Game of Crimes. We just did our case of the month. We've got the Narcometer coming up. Warden of the Throne episode exclusive for those of you at our highest levels. We've got 911 coming up, our Q&A, and you can't make this shit up. We do a lot of stuff on Patreon. I mean, yeah. We do a lot of content.
And you, if you're new to the show here on Game of Crimes, we're on Patreon. Here we stay apolitical. We want people to tell their story. It's about them, not about us. On Patreon, we get a little more opinionated. We'll tell you our thoughts on a lot of topics. They may not agree with your thoughts, but you know what? That's fine. We can all have different opinions and still be friends. So come over and check us out. It's a lot of fun. There's a lot of seriousness on that side also. The ones we talked about today, one of the cases I brought up about children, the way they are killed by their parents, just broke my heart. So come over and check us out.
I'm going to get a soundtrack that anytime you say we can just be friends, I'm going to have that little soundtrack playing in the back. Why can't we be friends? All right, guys, why can't we be friends? Well, we can. You can be friends. Just listen to our podcast, share one, tell one. But thank you guys once again for playing the biggest, baddest, most dangerous, and redacted game of all, the Game of Crimes.